All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Canadian Bowler Podcast. As always, not always, I'm your host, Lucas Caldwell, and I'm here with my beautiful co-host, Daryl Fitzgerald. Daryl, how's it going today?
Awesome. It's getting to Christmas. I'm wearing my festive shirt. Santa twerking. You love it?
Santa's looking thick over there.
Snow's on the ground, so I mean, you know, we're getting close to a new year. Everything's good.
Yeah, it's getting closer and closer every day. Christmas time, the most expensive time of the year, I suppose. Yeah. Most wonderful time of the year as well. I hope everyone out there gets to see their family and be healthy and have all that fun stuff like normal. Yeah. I know it's a strange times we live in, but we all know that by now. Alrighty, guys, you got to remember, you got to hit that subscribe button down there, the like button. Today we sit at 1,390 subscribers, which is insane. We've just been crushing lately. You guys have been crushing it for us. We appreciate it. Just remember to like, subscribe, share with all your friends. We got lots of original content coming out. There's already some out there. Anything in the bowl space related, it's all there for you guys for your viewing pleasures. If you can't watch the whole podcast today, remember that we're always available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Premium, all those things that are out there. I usually get posted up in about a week or so within the podcast. So that's great. And remember to like and subscribe and share with all your friends. That's pretty much it, I think.
Absolutely. Guys, just heading into Christmas and going over the holidays, we are taking a break. Obviously, we want to spend time with our friends and family and not think about work and podcasting and all the stuff that we do. But coming the new year, be prepared for a lot more content, a lot more stuff coming out. We've got events coming back. We've got exciting interviews lined up, lots of great stuff. So don't forget to, you know, hit that notification and subscribe so that you know when we come back and you know exactly what's coming out.
Yeah, there is also, I did forget to mention it, but Daryl touched on it. There's a little notification bell. It's right beside the red subscribe button there if you haven't hit it already, and that'll give you a notification, I think, to your email, or if you have an app on your phone that you're logged into, whenever anything goes live on our channel, you'll get a notification right away, so you won't miss anything.
And just so you know, Luke doesn't have Omicron.
No, I do feel a little, I don't know if I feel under the weather. I may be a little hungover. And there's a cat crawling on me, and I have a cat allergy, so that doesn't help either. But no, I think I'm healthy anyways.
Perfect. So what do we want to get into first? Do we want to do some of the...
let's cover some news first. Let's go with some news.
All right. How about we just get this right out of the way? We've had a lot of conversations on this show about championship selection for Canada. So how did the host clubs get picked? Who went in for the Canadian hosting bids for the majors and for the mixed pairs and all that kind of stuff? And we threw out a bunch of questions, like, because we didn't really know the background. And I want to give a shout out to Derek McKay, who actually reached out to us and said he was on the committee that did all this. He laid out a bunch of stuff that happened, but then, even more importantly, got in contact with Jake Shuknick at BCB, Bowls Canada, and he gave me kind of the official rundown of exactly what happened, how people were picked, and all that kind of stuff. So I just want to run through that now because it's kind of the official one. Pre-COVID, if you know, there's always a calendar of rotational provinces. So if it's Ontario has majors this year, it'll be another province next year, and then another province the next year, and it'll just keep rotating. So when COVID hit, all the events were canceled, and that rotational kind of pattern stopped. When 2021 rolled around, again, we canceled everything, so then the rotation stopped again. There was nothing going on. BCB actually hired an expert to go over the data because the majors, the way they are now, was only supposed to be a pilot project to see if it would work and see how things were going. I guess at the end of the day, there wasn't enough data because of all the cancellations. So they've decided to continue that going. So come the spring and summer of 2021, what they did was they took the rotational schedule and they gave anybody that was supposed, any province that was supposed to get it, first right of refusal. So if Alberta was supposed to get the majors, which they were given kind of the first go at, say, hey, do you want to still host this? If not, we'll go to an open bid process. Same with the mixed pairs. It was supposed to go to Nova Scotia. They didn't want to keep that, so it went into a pot and said, okay, we'll do an open bid process. The youth was supposed to go to Ontario, and Ontario said, yes, we do, and we want to find a host for it, and that's where Port Credit and James Gardens comes in, so that's where that's being hosted. So when you get to the bid process, unfortunately, nobody really put up their hand to bid. It was a short time frame, but only Ontario clubs actually put in their bid. And that's why Ontario clubs got these events. So the short version is the events that went to a bid process, only Ontario bid. That's why they're in Ontario. So it's a weird situation, but really nobody kind of put up their hand and said, hey, I want to do this. And that's the way it went. So in August, they put out the application, really short window so that they could get hosts lined up and get them going. They received one applicant for the majors. That's it. Three for the mixed pairs. And they were all in Ontario. So that's really where we ended up. And I guess the question now lies, like, why don't people want to host? How do we get more people wanting to host? There's a lot of benefits that come with it. You know, there's financial benefits, there's community benefits, there's legacy items, like if you need greens maintenance and all that kind of stuff. But really, at the end of the day, it's how do we get more bids? How do we get more people wanting to host the majors and not just the same clubs doing it over and over again? I think that's a fair summarization, Luke.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. Obviously, I read through the same email that you received from the or two emails you received from the two replies we got. I do just want to kind of say one thing on it, though. I think people that listen to the show need to understand that each person on the show has their own personal opinion about things. Sometimes there isn't quite enough information, so things might be a little misleading. But that's pretty much it. And I just wanted to thank Bulls Canada, Jake Shuknik, and Amis for actually reaching out and giving us more of a definitive reason of why things are the way they were. Maybe those are things that should be public knowledge in the future. Maybe not. Who knows? And thanks to Derek Mackay as well. And other than that, I think we can leave it there.
Perfect. Bulls Scotland announced their team for the Commonwealth Games.
Yeah, that's exciting. I mean, lots of these selections are probably going to be coming out here in the future. I hope we get the Canadian one here soon, Daryl. That'd be pretty exciting to see who's going to be on that.
I guess I don't know what position Scotland is in as far as playing and doing all this stuff, but they're pretty early from what I can think of from a lot of the teams. I think there's still a lot of countries that haven't been able to play, haven't been able to do anything. So, you know, how do you pick the team from 2019, really? Like, so anyways, Team Scotland's been announced. We wanted to give them the congratulations that they deserve. So on the women's side, we've got Lauren Bailey-White. Hopefully I said her last name correctly. Carolyn Brown, Dee Hogan, Claire Johnson, and Hannah Smith. And on the men's side, we've got the three obvious ones, Paul Foster, Alex Marshall, and Darren Burnett. They've been a mainstay on this team for quite some time. And we've got Stuart Anderson and Ian McLean on there. Really, all I have to say is I don't think they can go wrong with their teams. They have so much depth in Scotland. I can just imagine what the competition is like to get on this team. So congratulations to these 10 competitors, and good luck in Birmingham, 2022.
Yeah. Like I said before, it's going to be exciting coming up in the next few months or however long it is up until the Commonwealth Games, seeing these team selections coming out from across the board. So it's nice to see the Scotland one. And I guess just while we're on the topic, I guess we can kind of talk about what's going on the show today. So we do have a very special interview today with Karen Murphy, who's the assistant coach of the Australian national team. And if you know anything about bowls, you know who Karen Murphy is. A legend in the sport, won this many championships in team game singles, obviously very prevalent in the women's singles from Australia, winning a couple national championships, probably lots of national championships, actually a couple world championships, I meant Commonwealth Games and all that fun stuff. So basically what we're doing with these interviews is trying to get a bunch leading up to the Commonwealth Games with competitors, coaches, so on and so forth. And we have a couple that are lined up already because of the Australian national program has actually been very gracious to allow us to interview some of their staff and players. So that's quite interesting, I think, anyways, and hopefully we can get a few more. I'm sure we will, but
do we want to throw it to the Karen Murphy interview? And
yeah, let's do it. So I do just want to let you guys know, if for anybody in the chat, I'm not sure how many people we got in here today, but this is a pre-recorded interview. So if there's any questions, we can do our best to answer them for you at the end of the interview, but it will be no answers from Karen Murphy today.
All right.
All right. Well, I just want to start off by saying again, thank you very much, Karen, for coming to do this for us today. It's kind of a big deal for us. You're a bit of a legend in the space, if you will. The way I usually like to start off my interviews is for people who might not quite know you as well as some other people do. Who is Karen Murphy today?
Karen Murphy today. Karen Murphy's working today. I've got a full-time role with Bowls Australia as the national assistant coach. So, just recently retired 2 years ago from playing internationally after 22 years and, really enjoying my new role and, into the workforce. So it's been good fun.
So we did write down some of your achievements here. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but we have 8 World Bowls medals. 4 of them were gold. 4 Commonwealth Games medals, 1 gold, 3 silver, 1 World Bowls Tour title, and 13 Asia Pacific medals, and 8 of them were gold. Among those, do you have one that you could pick out as maybe your favorite one?
Yeah, it's a hard question. I think I've probably got a top 3, if you don't mind, Luke, but sure. If I had to pick one, it would probably be my first world singles title, the gold medal in the singles where I played Val Smith in Adelaide in 2012. So it was 9 years ago this week, actually. And your famous bowler, Kelly McCarrahan, was also involved in the singles, I think, in that year. So that was very special. My family were there. It was the stands were packed. The green was flying. So that was very special. And then probably not in any order from here, but, yeah, I was able to back it up 4 years later in Christchurch and win back-to-back world singles, which was really good. Played Kelly in the semi-final there. And the third one would be my gold medal in the pairs in Melbourne at the Commonwealth Games with Lindsay Clark, Nee Armitage, in front of a home crowd. So, they're probably my top three, just moments that you probably will never relive again, I suppose, but so happy to have achieved those things, I guess, and then also the with the people that I achieved them with, including family and supporters and friends and teammates.
So over that long-standing career and all those achievements, who would you say was your toughest opponent?
Yeah, I would say Joe Edwards. So Joe's from New Zealand. During my career, I played a lot of singles. And so did Joe. So we actually started at the very same time, and we pretty well retired at the same time as well after 22 years. I think I might have done a year more than Joe, but probably went and played through an era over that 22 years where I saw, obviously there was a lot younger singles players playing in the World and Commonwealth Games in the back end of my career. But at the start, there was another lady called Marlene Castle who played 20 years for New Zealand, and she was a gun. She was such a good draw bowler, and she was a really great opponent, still a really good friend of mine. But Joe probably over the majority of that was, you know, we call each other frenemies. So we're friends, but enemies on green, and had some really, really great battles. And along with that, you know, singles players wise, Kelly's, you know, still going really well, really tough opponent. Lena from Malaysia is a great player. Caroline Brown from Scotland. So it was an era where there was a lot of strength, I guess, in the ladies singles.
Just kind of keeping on the same topic of difficulty and tough things. So we spoke a little bit about weather conditions and things before the show. What do you think, or which country do you think had the toughest conditions you had to play in?
For us, the UK is always a real tough place to play. I've never had the privilege of playing in Canada. I think I just sort of missed when I started. Yeah, so one day, hopefully, I'd like to get over there or as a coach or even play over in Canada. But yeah, the UK, because our greens in Australia are very well maintained by paid green keepers who put a lot of time into them, and you put your bowl down, it goes exactly where it should most of the time, depending on the wind. But the UK is quite uneven. They generally have council green keepers and things like that that maintain the greens. You know, I remember in Leamington, going the first time I went to Leamington in 2004, they had fishing line running down the boundary pegs and the boundary lines of the rink. And at times, you know, the fishing line's touching the grass, but then at other times it's sort of, you know, that far off. So the hills and valleys, like in preparation, you know, for Birmingham for next year with our Australian Jackaroo team, we can replicate the pace. So the pace is not a problem. You know, we can get up, no problem, on the heavy greens. It's the hills and valleys and using the use of the mat and trying to stand to the inside to try and miss the runs and things. That's what we're not used to. And it's more of it's a style of play, so we have to change our style of play. Like, we're very much touch players, like an indoor game where you just draw to the jack sort of thing. In the UK, it's a different style, and you also adapt your style to the condition of the rink as well, you know, sort of thing. So if it's you might want to just try and avoid one hand if you can, or play bigger weight. So, you know, yeah, there's lots in it. So not what we're used to, and it's more, I think, affects us more from a mental point of view, in that it's frustrating that, you know, the bowls just don't always go where you want them to.
For all our Northern Hemisphere viewers and those in Canada, we know that all too well. It's still frustrating, even though you've, like, for someone like me that's played for 20 years on the same conditions, it's still frustrating. So I can just imagine what it's like for you guys coming up.
Yeah, I think it's how you react to it, isn't it? You know, yes. Like, it's a total mental thing, and that's something that our players are really working hard on. And looking back as the type of person, I'm very much ducks in a row. I like structured things. I'm a list girl and things like that. And so, you know, to me, it was very frustrating. I had some success on the outdoors in the UK, but it's still a very much a challenge. Whereas, you know, when you guys or the UK players come over to Australia and you're playing on an 18 second green in the wind, that's challenging too. Yeah.
For the players that look up to you, I know there's a lot of people that look up to Australian players. We see you all the time because a lot of your games are on YouTube or televised or streamed. Especially for women that look up to someone like yourself, what would you attribute to the reason for not only the success, the height of the success that you've had, but the longevity that you had in the sport?
Yeah, I think starting young, starting at 11 years of age with my dad in a sport that, you know, I could sort of share with him was fairly special. My story of my career is quite unique in that, you know, there was very few junior bowlers when I first started. I grew up in a small coastal town 2 hours south of Sydney. There wasn't much to do if you didn't play sport. There wasn't much to do apart from that. So, but I did sort of, I joined an Illawarra Academy of Sport where I only played with young guys. So there was no young girls, you know, and it wasn't cool when in my teens to play bowls at all. So I didn't tell anyone at school, but I was a sports and still am sports mad. So, played other sports as well, but I quickly learned to play that aggressive style of game with young guys, which was really beneficial to my game, I suppose, because in those days when we wore long white skirts and big ugly hats and things like that, that wasn't cool either. Made sure I got petrol the day before going to bowls in that get up so I didn't have to get it on the way to bowls. But, you know, it was... Yeah, I saw a big change. I've seen a big, big change in the game over the, you know, over my career of, you know, I started in 85. So, you know, the average age of the Australian women's team when I first got in was probably 60 something. You know, wow. Now the average age of when I retired, the average age of our Aussie girls team is probably around 27.
Wow.
So, yeah, so I guess, you know, looking back, you know, like I hope, you know, you don't think about a legacy until you finish. You know, you don't really realise what you're doing or who you're influencing or encouraging as you play. But, you know, I hope in some way that, you know, I have been able to encourage, you know, a few younger girls in getting into the game and young men. The shortened formats of the game, barefoot bowls over in Australia, the Commonwealth Games every 4 years, you know, has really heightened the profile of our sport and in, you know, the uniform change, like a massive, massive stereotype changer for the sport, you know, looks like we're playing bowls now compared to when I first started. So, but longevity wise, I think I love the game. I became fairly good fairly quickly, you know, playing against a lot of older ladies, different style of game, came in, probably ruffled a couple of feathers, I would imagine. You know, the older ladies, it wasn't the norm, was it? So, but I was also had a bit of a skill to be quite relatable to that age group as well. And, yeah, I guess just that hunger to win. I'm an absolute fighter and hate losing, so I'm super, super competitive. I wear my heart on my sleeve a fair bit, you know, I guess just the passion for the game. And you know, when I decided to retire, you know, I sort of knew it was time. So new pastures now.
You got this one, Daryl.
I got this one. All right. One thing that I've been watching for a while, you have a side project and a side business, Karen Murphy Bowles Clinics, and I'm really interested to know what got you to start that up, especially while you were still playing and at the top of your game, and how that has propelled you to where you are today, actually being the assistant coach of the Jackaroos.
Yeah, it's a good question, Daryl. I guess when I was a younger player, and even when I first made the Australian team, there wasn't a lot of really good quality coaching around. So I definitely identified a need for it, I guess. That was probably one thing. So I started my business in 2010, and the reason why I started my bowls clinics was, number one, that reason. And number two, I'd actually just missed out on the 2010 Delhi Commonwealth Games. So it was the only games I missed out on for the games. It was a really rough time in my life. I was at the top of my game, you know, number one in Australia and World and Commonwealth Games gold medalist. It wasn't to be at the time. I was in a pretty rough space, and I thought I need something to sort of focus my interest in, you know, somewhere else and throw my efforts into something else. And I had a conversation with one of the older guys up at Tweed Heads, who was a really good friend of mine, Norm Carmichael, who suggested it to me. And I thought, wow, that's a great idea. You know, there's a real need for it, sort of thing. So the format around Vols Clinics was one-on-one coaching, and then also group training, where I used to travel around and sort of train mostly ladies, but quite a few men as well, and just teach them what, you know, and pass on the knowledge and experience that I've gained and from what I know of other players as well. And, you know, sometimes I think if you're being coached by a club coach or something like that, sometimes, you know, like as great a coach as these guys can be, sometimes it just takes someone else from outside your square just to say one thing to you, and it might really resonate and think, oh, yep, I'm going to try that, and take someone else to say it differently or show something different. So coaching's a real passion of mine. You know, like I feel like, you know, within my strengths as a person, you know, we do a lot of strengths testing, you know, personality and all these sort of things. And I've done hundreds, you know, not hundreds, but I've done quite a few of those in different courses and things, and they all come up the same, you know, sort of thing. So the qualities, you know, that a lot of our pathways coaches that in Australia here, you know, relate to, so being relatable to the person. I think when you get to the Jackaroo stage, an assistant coach like I am, you know, our Jackaroos know how to play. It's people management. You know, it's really finding what individually makes those players tick, and getting the best out of them individually to perform at their best. You know, as a person, you know, if you're happy, if you're in a really good space, if you put the preparation in and you've got that hunger, you know, that's where the spaces are, you know, in times where I've won and had success in my career is when that all comes together. And that's our job to get that out of the players and get the best out of them.
In the past, you've had some experience working with other countries and kind of developing their coaching programs, I believe, along the way. What has it been like working with different countries and seeing them improve?
Yeah, I've worked with a few different countries. When I was on the board of World Bowls for a few years and was the Asia and Oceania director. So I went to the Cook Islands and did some work with the Cook Islands players. And I've coached in New Zealand with my business. And I've been up to Malaysia, you know, a couple of times. So, yeah, like it's really interesting. You know, it's interesting to see how they do it, number one. And then I guess, you know, bringing and implementing new things into their game and getting them to think outside the box a little bit, you know, in how you prepare and how you train and then how you play the style of game as well. So, you know, bowls to me, you know, is to me 80% mental. You know, it's probably 20% skill and 80% mental. And I say that because we are a unique sport in that we've got so much downtime to think in between shots. You know, it's not like ice hockey where you guys are just on the run, thinking on the run and, you know, sort of and having that skill as well as thinking, you know, on the spot. Bowls isn't like that. You know, you play a bad bowl, you've got a lot of time to dwell on it. So what you do with that time is really, really important sort of thing. So, so developing your mental game, you know, going through your processes, it's not unlike any other sport. Ice hockey, they would also have processes and things, you know, in the way that they play. Bowls is the same. From the time you pick your bowl up, your processes that you go through, well, when you step onto the mat, set your feet, pick your line, you know, positive reinforcement and doing the same thing every time. Rafael Nadal, he's probably OCD process, you know, like his labels is to the front and you know, he in the Australian Open, he walks through the N every time before he serves, every single time, does the hair, does the shorts, but that's his process and that works for him. So all sports are the same and bowls is no different.
I like that you brought up the mental side. We've in Canada have just started pushing that quite a bit. And players have really taken to it and seem to be wanting more. They haven't had it for most of their bowls career, and they're really starting to zone in on the mental aspect where routines and visualization and all those kind of things play a part. How has that, I guess in Australia, has that been received really well, or is there still people that don't realize just how important that is?
I think there's a lot of people that probably don't realize that unless they learn it, you know. So unless, I guess, you can't really learn the mental side of the game whilst you're playing. You know, I think the mental side of the game is probably learnt from talking to good players, good coaches and things like that, you know. And I look at the top players in the world. You know, your Alex Marshalls, your Paul Foster, Ryan Bester, you know, Joe Edwards. The common thing mentally that I think that they've got in common is that they've got very, very good emotional management skills. So they stick to their processes, but when the going gets tough, you know, they don't let themselves get to that point where their emotions take over. Because as soon as you are playing badly or you play a bad shot or something like that, you get emotional, and then a reaction from your emotion naturally is to tighten up physically. So you tighten up through your shoulders, and then you can't get your delivery away. So an effective technique is all about being able to repeat that effective technique and it feeling the same all the time. So they have, you know, mechanisms in place where, you know, when things aren't going so well, you know, whether it be breathing, slowing down, getting back to basics, going in, getting a drink, just resetting themselves and not letting them get themselves to that point where they become emotional. Because as soon as you do, yeah, you're gone. So that's what I would say. You know, if there's a tip out there for people watching, you know, really work on your mental game and work on managing those emotions really effectively.
That's a great tip.
So something that I think kind of goes hand in hand with mental health and mental strength in the game of bowls is healthy eating and fitness. Obviously, over the years, it's kind of been a question as of if you really need to be the most physically fit or well-fed person, I guess, in the world to be an elite bowler. Do you think that that should be more of a focus, or do you think that the way it is okay?
Look, I think it really depends on the individual. So obviously you don't need to be the fittest person to play bowls. However, I think it comes down to the individual. So for me in my career, you know, I've always kept fit, gone to the gym, eaten really well, even to the point where, and I still get, you know, paid out for it by Jackaroos and former teammates and things like that. Like, I take a cooking kit away with me every time I go away. We try and stay in apartments. I've got a good knife. I've got a potato peeler. I've got salt and pepper and all this sort of stuff, because when we're away on tour, you know, I love to cook. You know, the girls would all get into a room. You know, I would generally cook, the girls would help, you know, they'd make a salad or something like that, and we made an effort to eat really well while we're away. If you're eating takeaway every night, which you don't normally do at home every night, do you? You know, why would you do that when you're away playing in one of a world championships or something like that? So with the Jackaroos, you know, we've got a bit of a drinking rule as well while we're on tour. So, you know, we're really mindful of getting a good sleep, you know, stretching, you know, eating really well, doing the things that you would normally do at home in looking after yourself. And for me, you know, staying fit and reasonably slim was wonderful for your mental health. You know, like, you know yourself when you go to the gym, how great it makes you feel. So those endorphins are released. And for me, I always, my motto was, you know, if I look good and feel good, I'm going to play well. You know, Christmas is coming up in a couple of weeks, everyone at home. You know, there's nothing worse than when you know, we all do it. We all have a few beers and tuck into the food and that, and it just makes you feel terrible. So it's a healthy balance. You know, I've seen players that haven't done that over the years, but for me individually, it really worked and it made me feel great. You know, so if I felt great, you know, I felt confident and I put the preparation in and away you go.
Yeah, I've noticed over the years when we go away, for instance, when Luke and I kind of first became really good friends, we were at the World Youth Championships in Broadbeach, and the lunches that were provided were great, but they were so heavy. It was like fish and chips and bangers and mash and all that kind of stuff. You eat that at lunch, and the afternoon is shot because you're so tired and you're just trying to process all that stuff. Healthy eating is awesome. And I've noticed that through your coaching page, you post, you know, a lot of great things about healthy eating, really good recipes. Has that been sort of a big thing for you as a coach as well?
Yeah, I think so, Daryl. Like, I'm lucky I've got a real passion for cooking as well. So, you know, I love getting in the kitchen. I love making new recipes. Only the other day, like, Christmas is over, you know, it's at our house this year again. So I was just, you know, Googling new salads and things just to change it up a bit sort of thing. And, you know, like, it's, it is. It's a real passion. I'm lucky that I enjoy that sort of thing too. So, you know, I think the emphasis on fitness and healthy eating, not only from a bowls point of view, but even from a society point of view in Australia, you know, we've got great weather. You know, everyone's always out and about, you know, walking, running, riding your bike, all that sort of stuff. There's, you know, why not try and incorporate that into your sport? And, you know, and there's, you know, one of my passions, and I know Gary's the same, I'd be interested to see if, you know, if you ask him the same question, where, you know, if you interview him and when you do. But what we really want to see as new coaches and a new HP team, we want to see the Aussies the fittest team in the world. You know, walk into a club and, you know, all our players are fit. They're at the peak of their, you know, of their fitness and, you know, can bring that element of their game, of their outside their game into, you know, like a World Championships or a Commonwealth Games next year. So You know, one, it's quite, you know, it's quite daunting, you know, like to see a sea of yellow come in, but, you know, if they're all fit and that sort of thing, then, you know, I guess, you know, other countries might look at that and think, wow, you know, that could be something that we could adopt or, yeah, but certainly helps.
Just want to ask you, now that you've transitioned from being a player to a coach, what has that been like? Like, has there been any strange interactions? Because, I mean, you were once a player, you were once part of the team, under the coaching and doing all that, and now you're actually on the other side coaching the team.
It's a great, really great question, Daryl. So I retired just before COVID hit at the end of 2019. So had sort of, well, what, I don't know about you guys, it was probably very similar timelines, but, you know, COVID hit sort of in the obviously first half of last year, and we were in lockdown here for maybe 6 or 7 weeks, I think, in Sydney. So there wasn't a lot of bowls on. It was very unknown, obviously. So last year I hardly played and loved it, loved lockdown. I thought it was the best thing. Got lots of different things done, and pardon me, and I just enjoyed the break, you know. For the viewers out there that don't sort of realise, you know, the Australian schedule, all our players are all sort of contracted to clubs out here. They so they have club, district, zone, state commitments on top of all their Jackaroos commitments as well. So, you know, doing that year after year, it was exhausting, you know, and it was the same all the time, you know, for me sort of thing. So when I did retire, I actually really enjoyed having some downtime, having a lot of time at home. So lockdown was really good. You know, I was getting out in the backyard and, you know, getting the weights out every day and doing things like that. So for me, I didn't miss having retired and all that sort of stuff because my teammates weren't playing any events anyway. And they still haven't. Sure. They still haven't. So it's, you know, I missed the connection, I suppose, from, you know, we have a lot of chat groups and things like that. I probably missed that side of it. But then I came on board with BA as the assistant coach. So I'm back being involved in a different role. So I feel like I'm back involved anyway. So I sort of, you know, that sort of ticked that box. But from a having been a player and being really close to the team and now being a staff member where, you know, I guess that's going to be, you know, and I haven't done it yet. We actually haven't got together. We've rescheduled camps and Commonwealth Games trials and things like that. So our first camp, hopefully, is in about 4 weeks' time. So that is going to be a bit of a different challenge. You know, we haven't all been together where I've been on staff and I'm now an Australian selector and working with my teammates. But, you know, the great positive is that I know them so well. We've all got a really healthy respect for each other. And that, you know, I'm super passionate about assisting them, helping them and supporting them in any way to, you know, for them to reach their goals and for the team to reach our goals as well, you know, sort of thing. So I'd give my left arm for the team to be successful. And I know what it's like, you know, like it's a great feeling, you know, when you put all that preparation and effort and doing all those little one percenters. And for it to come off, there's no better feeling. So, yeah, I feel like I've got some goals to kick from a coaching point of view. You know, like a couple of coaches have said to me, you wait until one of your players wins a world title or something like that. It's as good as winning one yourself. So yeah. Hopefully, fingers crossed.
I guess just kind of staying on the same subject of breaking away from the same old, same old. Obviously, we spoke about it. You competed in all of the big events, the biggest events in the world. Was there any like small or like local, like hidden gem tournaments that you actually found a lot of enjoyment from aside from the big ones?
Yeah, good question. It's probably not small, but it's not at the international stage as such, but I was really fortunate to have played for many, many years and still will probably in the Australian indoor. So, and the Golden Nugget tournament at Tweed Heads. So, Tweed Heads has been a really great hunting ground for myself. You know, like I remember going up as a junior and watching some of the players at the Golden Nugget when I was 14, you know, and just thinking, wow, that's awesome. You know, look at the crowd. There's like a couple of thousand people here watching a tournament on the Gold Coast. So, went on to win. I was really lucky to enough to win five nuggets and went on to win six Australian indoors. So, yeah, the Australian indoor to me is a really great event. The winners of the Australian indoor go to the World Cup. I've played in that quite a few times, but yeah, I guess for on an Aussie scale, the indoor and Tweed Heads nugget is up there sort of thing. I'm not sure whether your viewers would know what those are.
They might know what the Golden Nugget is for sure. Ryan's competed in it, so if they follow Ryan at all, they kind of know what that is. But it's from what I've seen, it's a fantastic event and really big too.
Ryan sort of has more jacks that sort of end up off the rink than on it. I've seen some go through the window. I've seen him break a couple of jacks at the nugget. And the crowd just love that stuff, you know, like he draws a crowd, that's for sure. So, but his drive draw game, you know, probably to me is the only player that I've seen successfully that's been able to incorporate that into their game was Rob Perella. So, fantastic drive, used to stand his bowl up, sort of turn it in his hand a little bit, you know, and just come back to the draw and draw within, you know. Yeah, so Ryan's probably the next best player that I've seen be able to do that.
I liken it to some sports here, like baseball. When people are hitting home runs, everybody loves it. It doesn't necessarily win you games, but it can be excitement because it's that big explosion, that big play that everybody can see. It's kind of interesting to see. Ryan's drives are always something to behold. Everybody wants to see one because they heard so much about it.
Yeah. Man, he's good at it. You know, like he uses it well in his game as a weapon. So yeah.
Right. So again, talking about the fact that you've played in so many different formats, BPL, UBC, you know, indoor, overseas, Commonwealth Games, etc. We've talked about it on our program. There's a lot of talk about the international game, Commonwealth Games and World Bowls, and the fact that it's really hard to market, it's really hard to watch sometimes, especially for the casual fans. People like Luke and I, who are kind of hardcore, we might just watch it anyway, regardless of what's going on. But for those that are just tuning in for trying to bring in a new audience, sitting down and watching an hour, 2 hour, 3 hour game of bowls can be very, very difficult. Since you've played in all these events, is there anything that you see that would, I guess, make sense at an international stage to improve the game, even at the Commonwealth or World Bowl stage?
Yeah, I think I think you're right. Like sitting down and watching a three-hour game of, you know, even a team game probably especially, but even a singles game, you know, we need as a sport, and having been on the board of World Bowls, you know, we need to as a sport keep coming up with shortened formats of the game, exciting formats like every other sport's doing. You know, you look at the Olympics a couple of months ago, you know, they had rock climbing, they had surfing, they had skateboarding. Rugby Sevens has changed formats, you know, within their sport to, you know, I think they're 15-minute halves or something like that. So if we don't move with the times, you know, like our sport will get lost, you know, sort of thing. So BPL, you know, for Bowls Premier League in Australia has been a wonderful event from a televised point of view, from a playing point of view, to sell the game. You know, it markets really well, you know, the way in which the TV production sets it up and things like that, great commentary, sells our game really well. But I think from a player point of view, I agree that we need to do it. You know, so, and even at Commonwealth Games next year, it'll only be red and blue bowls. So the countries will only be playing with red and blue bowls. It's another topic. but it's a great spectator selling point, you know, so very easily identifiable with the teams. But from a playing point of view, you don't find sometimes that the best players always win in those formats. So, you know, the top players need to probably change their game plan a little bit too, I guess, to try and, you know, work out the format. There's a lot of, as you guys know, there's a lot of luck involved in bowls. There is at times. But I think if you're, you know, if you're in the area with your shot, you know, any result that comes off, you're in the area, then happy days. But we need to do it. You know, I really think we need to do it. Our sport at a Commonwealth Games level is now not a core sport. So we used to be one of the five core sports. And that's not the case now, only of the last couple of months. So it comes down to the country that the Commonwealth Games are the host. They actually get to choose what sports. And we may, as a sport with bowls, miss out on a Commonwealth Games depending on the country that it's played in, you know, and that's we're not an Olympic sport, so that could be detrimental to bowls, you know, from a funding point of view and from a profile point of view. That's not been great news, so even more reason why we need to keep implementing shorter formats of the game and make it exciting for the viewer.
I guess the last question that I have for you, and you kind of answered it already, but what do you think that the Commonwealth Games means to the sport?
It's to the sport, or to me, it was our Olympics.
Yeah.
It was, you know, and I think you know, the majority of the players would have the same answer. You know, the top players in the world would have the same answer. It is our Olympics, you know, so as I said, detrimental. If we weren't in the Commonwealth Games, it would be... have a really negative flow-on effect for bowls, sort of thing. So, you know, I'm sure your guys, you know, your funding for your country, say in Canada and other countries, your funding's dependent on performance-based, isn't it? You know, so we're the same in Australia. Funding would be cut, jobs could be lost, you know. But it's the pinnacle for me. I mean, World Champs and Commonwealth Games are... You know, like you talk to Olympians that go to the Olympics and it's like the best thing they've ever done, you know, and for us, I guess the Commonwealth Games is also because it's a multi-sport event, but winning a world title's pretty well on a par with that or playing in a world championship. So, yeah.
I guess going back to something that you just mentioned, maybe to wrap things up, there's lots of changes that are happening at the international level that they're trying to make it a little more marketable, a little more visible, easier to understand, let's say. The color bowls, red and blue. Do you have any thoughts on that kind of change for the Commonwealth Games?
Look, I think it's a... That's a great idea. You know, like you look at Potters, you know, like I've played at Potters many, many years, and easily identifiable. They've got obviously the green and the red, blue and the red. Yeah, it's from a TV point of view and from a marketing point of view, I think it's great. From a team point of view, there are a few sort of, you know, issues, I guess, that come up with that. Number one, like I know our team won't be just taking one model of bowl over to Leamington. So if you've got to have a red and a blue set, and maybe, for example, one of our players might take a Tiger 2 and a Tiger, then you've got to have four sets of bowls. That causes issues from a manufacturing point of view. It causes issues from a, you know, having to get them over there and carry them from a weight point of view on the plane and all this sort of thing. I believe there will be a pool of bowls over at the Commonwealth Games from manufacturers and things like that. Are you guaranteed, if you don't bring sets of bowls as a country, are you guaranteed to get the same set that you had last game in red? Maybe not. Someone might have grabbed them before you. Look, I think it seems to work really well at Potters because a lot of players have their own sets and generally, you know, bring them themselves. But a lot of overseas players play with the pool bowls.
Yeah.
But there's only a handful of players that use it out of the pool bowls. We're talking... countries and countries and countries in the Commonwealth Games relying on those pool sets. So, look, it's going to be interesting to see, but I think, again, from a marketing point of view and changing our sport from a television point of view, it's a good idea.
It's interesting. We've had discussions about the bowls on our side as well, and while I totally agree with the marketing, going back to the mental side, do you have... any thoughts that some players may find it really tough not to play with their own set of bowls? It's like get over that mentally that I've got this random set of bowls, even though an ace is an ace or a tiger is a tiger, that it's going to be just that little bit of a bump in their game?
Well, I think, definitely. If you bought if you bought two Toyota cars, are they the same?
Right.
Probably not. But from a mental point of view, I guess, you know, and I'm probably, you know, going back to the Potters when I played there, you know, you get comfortable with a bowl in your hand, and they can differ a little bit, you know, like between models a little bit. So, you know, when you're drawn to play in green at Potter, say, for example, but you really love your red set, you know, all of a sudden that mental sort of thing kinks in. Geez, you know, I wish I had the other set, but I think it's how you react to it, really. And, you know, I think on the slower greens, it probably won't be as much of an issue, sort of thing. So that's how you react to it. Just if it feels comfortable in your hand, and you know, you just play with what you've got. So
awesome.
Well, Karen, I just wanted to thank you again for coming on the show on behalf of myself, Daryl, and Michael, the third part of the show here. Thank you very much. We really do appreciate your time and you coming on the show to talk to us today. I wish you and your Jackaroos the best of luck going forward. Hopefully everything works out with COVID and whatnot. And I guess just thanks again.
Yeah, no problem, guys. Anytime you want to have a chat, that's great. You know, really love what you're doing for the sport. And promoting it, it's great. And you know, getting overseas players and things on there, I think it's some great lessons for the viewers out there to be able to you know, get some tips and things off different players from around the world. So well done, you guys, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Daryl, we're back.
Whew. What an interview.
Yeah, it was a great one. I actually really enjoyed doing that one. That was a good one. Karen Murphy, again, just a great person to have a conversation with. Extremely knowledgeable in the sport, had been there, done that sort of thing, right? So
some interesting stuff. I want to give a quick shout out to Adam Randall. We don't talk about it much on stream, but he found the monetization buttons.
Yeah, thanks, Adam Randall, and a friend of mine, Garrett. I don't want to even butcher your last name, but Garrett, thanks for the $10 super chat, I think they're called on here, and Adam for the $7.99 super chat.
Yeah.
Obviously, guys, we don't talk about it because we don't ask for money from anybody, but if you do want to support the show, there is an option out there.
Yeah,
I guess
everything that goes into the show goes back into the, or comes from the show goes back into the show. We're looking to keep upgrading our stuff, our cameras. There you go, right there. It's much appreciated because obviously otherwise we're just trying to make do with what we have. So. Everything is much appreciated, especially come holiday time. So thank you very much. Merry Christmas, happy holidays to all those that have donated to us so far. It's great.
Yeah, like I said, we appreciate it. We don't ask for it. It's one of those things that's there. I don't even think we can turn it off if we wanted to. So we don't ask for it ever, but if someone chooses to do it, then obviously it's much appreciated. I guess just I want to go back, talk about that interview just a little bit, Daryl. And Karen kind of talked about things we need to change to make it more viewer-friendly, get it into the Olympics, the TV stuff. Like, what – like I know we've kind of talked about this before, but, like, what do you actually think needs to change so the sport can be bigger?
I take a look at for Canadians and obviously for some Northern Hemisphere – countries as well. I kind of look at curling and what they did. Curling was in the same kind of place we were. It was, you know, more of a casual game. They had their competitions, but they weren't televised. It wasn't super mainstream, but they worked their way. And I still believe they're still tweaking and adding formats to try to make it as marketable as possible. And I think bowls needs to do the same. We need to find a place for the traditional game, for the championships, for certain things. I think there's a place for it. And I love the traditional game, so I don't want to see that go away. But for the big shows, the TV time, the streaming, the grabbing of casual players, I think we need to shorten the time frame for games. We need to make it more exciting, a little more attacking, which people can, you know, hop on and say, you know, why would you want more drives? Why would you want more aggressive play? But it's exciting, and people want to see that. People love home runs in baseball. It's not the core part of the game, but you want to see people hit dingers, right? I mean, that's just
You look at it in every sport, right? Like the steroid era of baseball was probably the most popular era of baseball when Barry Bonds, Mark McGwire, Jose Canseco, Sammy Sosa, all those guys are just crushing 70 bombs a year. Yeah, it's exciting to watch. When I mean, obviously it's a little different, a little unsafe, but like back when Scott Stevens was still playing in the NHL, for any of you hockey fans out there, just those big massive game-changing hits are exciting. Stuff like that's exciting, and like I think the big drive is basically the only thing that we have that is like that. So yeah, people want to see it, and I think something needs to change. Is just something to make the game more marketable. The marketability of the sport's obviously there, but it's just, to me, it just seems so old school. Like we always just kind of fall back onto the same things, and like the game's never really evolved in my 20 years in the sport anyways.
I even see it at our local game. Like clubs are running the same style of tournament every day, every week. It's, you know, 3 games a day, 14 ends, you put in your money, you get a little bit out. And those are great for making it fairly easy to do. Everybody knows how to play those, but it's not exciting. Like, do I want to play that every single day of Bulls? No, I don't.
Well, it's like we've touched on it before, and like obviously, like there's the casuals and there's the diehards, and like myself, I would consider myself somewhere right in the middle of the two, and I love playing the game, but I have a hard time sitting down and watching a boring 18 and force game. Like it's really, like it's not that exciting, other than like maybe like a handful of shots here and there.
It's tough, and for someone like me, I think you could label me a hardcore. I could sit down and watch any game for any amount of time. But for other sports, I'm not as, you know, like right in there on it. I like shorter formats. I like to see, you know, the highlight plays and the big plays to get it. I don't want to sit through, I think Adam Randall just talked about cricket. I don't want to sit through days of cricket. Yeah, I want to sit and see brutal. Just a quick cricket match, and I find it exciting, but I don't like what the traditional one was, where it was days of competition. There's no way I would sit through it. So bowls is the same. I think there's a need to capture the casual crowd, and that's where we need to go. Is the hardcores are going to be there, you know, the people that have watched and continue to watch and are there day to day, they're going to be there. But we need to somehow grab that audience that is still on the fringe, doesn't want to sit through those games, and bring them in. And I think that's going to be the big boom for Bulls right there.
I also think, too, and I know I tried to talk about this on the last show, but I robo-voiced a little bit. I think the way we've marketed the sport for the last like 10, 15 years has been great, but I think there's it's just got to change, because like they're trying to push the game so much on youth, especially here in Canada, and unfortunately it doesn't work. I mean, it's a great idea. Obviously, I understand it adds longevity to the sport if you can get young guys like myself, or like when I joined, or even you, Daryl, you were young buck when you started. Like, it does add longevity. But like, for example, like just my personal experience, I remember my dad, we had short mat carpets, and we'd go into high schools and we would play for like spend a whole week of time, and you'd play with hundreds of kids. And your retention of players that you got out of it was what? Zero? Maybe one person came for a free lesson or something? Like, yeah. It just doesn't work. And I think the marketing of the sport has to be to the middle age to older people, just because we have to get people in the sport for the sport ever to grow, or it's never going to change. And like I said, I think it's great to get young people in, but the model clearly just isn't there.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there, where I think the marketing is like an older generation and families, because I think a lot of us, you and me specifically, for sure, brought in by our families, right? Our families played. We stayed because our dads played, our brothers and sisters played. And it, there were people to come and play with and enjoy the game. If I'm going out there by myself as a youth, even in other sports, I didn't stay. If I didn't have a group of friends, if I didn't have people kind of there with me, I lost interest pretty quick because it was just me out there.
Yeah, exactly. And like obviously it's unfortunate, but there's still like that, like I can call it like a stigma around the sport. Like when I played, I got torched in high school, just torched by people when I would play and whatever. But I mean, I think like we got to look at like the 50, 60 year old men and women who are newly retired, looking for a new hobby. I think really that's where you're going to get your new members for the most part. And then they can kind of like you basically just got to go off the word of mouth sort of thing. Cause at this point, I don't really think the marketing side is really working. I mean, I don't mean to trash on anybody. I never mean to do that. I think there needs to be a shakeup in the marketing, the format, and a few other things in the sport.
Yeah, I mean, we get ripped quite a bit as a sport just for our attachments to retirement communities, funeral homes, financial planning for retirement and whatnot. Obviously, we're like WBT. The funeral care sponsorships. It's where our sport kind of lies right now. Trying to get to that younger one, it's going to take a lot of time, but we need to first get that huge explosion of people in and playing and enjoying the sport and just keep growing that out. I'm trying to jump way ahead to just get a ton of youth in. It might not work that well.
Well, it's just like what I'm saying. Like, how many people have done the same thing that me and my dad did, where you go and spend X amount of hundreds of hours and basically just free promotion to a school or whatever, bring the kids over to the club and show them. It's just, yeah, it's great that they get to come out and try it, but no one ever stays.
Yeah, I've seen difficulty in that as well.
I just feel that like, not, I wouldn't say it's detrimental, but it's almost just like demoralizing for the volunteers that are essentially wasting their time.
I don't think it should stop. I think it's a good program,
not at all.
But I think there's something to be said for really marketing it towards older and family. Get those families in, get their families, then the kids will come with them. Maybe bring their friends because they want a group of people playing. I think that might be the way to go. But obviously, we're not marketing geniuses here, or
might be
bigger than we are right now. So,
yeah, absolutely. I guess another thing that just the last thing I really want to touch on about the interview is the colored bowl conversation that Karen brought up. I think it's a good idea. Yep. I think it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I think smaller countries like Canada. I mean, I guess we're pretty lucky compared to some of the other ones. But some of the smaller countries, I don't even know how to name them. I don't know how much funding's in them. Let's just throw a couple out there, like South Africa, Namibia, all these other ones. I don't know who's in the Commonwealth Games. I apologize. But I don't know how much funding's there. And if they have to carry all these sets of bowls, it's going to get pretty expensive, especially if there's no, like if there's a bowls company that's sponsoring and they got to have X odd number of bowls, that's a lot of money that you just throw out there.
Yeah, there's I can touch on that a bit, just knowing from the Bowls Canada side. Bowls Canada doesn't have a ton of money, and what they do funnel towards the high performance program, which is geared towards, you know, performance and medals and everything. Adding this on top of it makes the budget really tight. Trying to get bowls specific to every player, we're not going to be as lucky as if Australia is doing the multiple bowls, you know, everybody needs a couple sets. We're not going to be that lucky. So we're going to probably have a set per person. And if that set doesn't work out, you'll have to go to the pool bowls. So it's tough.
Yeah, it is really tough. I think it's a cool idea. Like Karen said, I think it's really good for TV.
I think so too.
And like, even just from not even on TV playing a game where, like, for example, I remember playing in the fours, and I'm playing against Mike Spatafora in the same position as me, and we have virtually identical bowls, and you can't tell the difference at the other end if you're trying to figure stuff out. So it can get a little tricky that way. So, yeah, I think it's pretty neat, though.
I think it's a good way to go. I'm interested to see if they'll always stick with the red and the blue. I mean, curling has the red, the blue, and the yellow. curling stones, so it's kind of like that. Or if eventually they'll allow countries or give countries colors to say, here's your national colors. So like Canada, red and white, Australia, green and gold, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, I guess the difference in curling is every curling rock's the exact same, right? Like there's no difference, right? They're all exactly the same.
They're supposed to be, but obviously manufacturer
use. No, but I mean like there isn't like a different bias or anything, right?
No, that's true.
They're virtually identical. Anyways, I guess we can move on. I don't know. I mean, we've been going for 65 minutes now, an hour five. I think we can probably wrap it up.
I think so too. It's been a great show though.
Yeah, that was a great show. The interview obviously was wonderful. If you're out there listening, Karen, thanks again. We really do appreciate it. Thanks to everyone in the chat today. Adam, Garrett, thanks for the super chat. The 17 bucks or whatever it ended up being. Thank you guys very much. We appreciate it. I guess don't forget to follow, like, subscribe, hit that little notification bell at the bottom. Adam said in the chat, rest and touch on that subscribe button and the like button down there. We'd be much appreciated. If you missed the first half of the show or part of the interview, don't worry, guys. We will be available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all those great ones out there for you in about a week. And this episode will be reposted to YouTube anytime now. I mean, it just takes moments after to upload the VOD here. Thanks, Daryl, for coming on with me today. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And until next time, guys, Merry Christmas, and I hope all your bowls are touchers.